Some thank yous. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank Arts Council England, sponsors of Ledbury Poetry Festival, now in its 25th year. I'd also like to thank our local sponsors of tonight's event, Butler and Sweatman, Homeware and Gift Shops, operating in Ledbury for almost as long as the festival, selling Emma Bridgewater, Alessi and many other leading designers. Now, usually, when I introduce a poet at the festival, I give a bit of background info, along with what I believe to be their actual name. You might have heard rumours that tonight's performer is not a natural Brian, but I want to reassure you, I've seen him up close and his roots are all Brian. He has a massive following on Twitter and is known as the Twitter Laureate. He's also gained the title of the Banksy of poetry, which I think means in between writing poetry, he's out stenciling on backstreet walls. Or in fact, he might actually be Banksy and the poetry is just to throw us off the scent. I don't know if he's heard of or is a member of the Live Poets Society founded by Henry Normal, because his writing definitely fits their motto. Poetry so good, you can actually understand it. So, reading from his recent collection, Alexa, What Is There to Know About Love? And previewing his forthcoming collection, Days Like These, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage, Brian Bilston.
There's so many of you. You do realise that Simon Armitage was last night, don't you? So I'm Brian Bilston, or someone pretending to be him. It's great to be back here at the Ledbury Poetry Festival. This is my second time. I was here a few years ago. And there's an old adage in show business that you play the Ledbury Poetry Festival twice in your career. The first time on your way up. And then now. So it's always good to have a kind of agenda for these kind of things. So agenda's quite simple. I'm going to read you some poems over the next hour. I'm probably going to read about 25 poems, which actually represents very good value for money. I mean, if you were to go and see someone like Carol Ann Duffy, for instance, she's currently operating around the 10 to 12 poem an hour mark. You're quite steady, quite steady. Whereas anyone who was at the Simon Armitage events last night, he barely read anything at all. It was just essentially him on stage, sat on a chair, playing Angry Birds on his phone. But I thought I'd get going with a poem for local residents here, because it can't be very easy having a kind of influx of poets into the town every year. You do have my sympathy. So here's a poem that offers some advice. It's called Poetry Festival, Advice for Residents. Check your doors are chained and padlocked. Keep your hatches battened down. Lock up your jewellery and your whiskey. There are poets in the town. They're kicking cantos down the high street. They're crooning in the chip shop queue. They're selling sin canes on street corners. They sprayed the bus stops with haiku. Do not venture out past midnight. Stay in bed, don't make a sound. Clutch your crucifix and garlic. There are poets in the town. They're soliloquizing down the precinct. They're expounding on the tram as well. They're slipping sonnets into handbags. They're lacing drinks with villanelles. If one's near, approach with caution. Lend them not a single pound. Walk in pairs, stick to the footpaths. There are poets in the town. They'll say one thing and mean another. They'll lie to you, they'll tell the truth. They'll coax you in with words of honey. They'll comfort you, console, seduce. They'll break your heart or make it leap. They'll leave you battered, soothed or warmed. Then leave your town in search of others. Please take care, you have been warned. So that's a poem from my forthcoming book, Days Like These. It's coming out in October, and I want to read another poem from that book to you now. So the premise of that book is there's a poem for every day of the year, and each poem kind of links in with something, you know, kind of particular about that day. And it could be an event in history, for instance. It could be the birth or death of somebody notable. It could be like a, you know, one of those kind of celebration days that you get these days, don't you? You know, sort of, you know, international coat hanger day or whatever. Whatever they are. So here's the entry for the 23rd of August. And yeah, you look quite a discerning bunch. You will almost certainly know that on that day in 1991, Tim Berners-Lee is credited with launching the very first website. And my poem for that day is entitled Before the Internet. Before the internet, if you wanted to waste time in the office, you had to stare aimlessly into the mid-distance or make a sculpture of Pauline Quirk out of paper clips. Before the internet, if you wanted to get yourself some followers, you had to form your own cult and offer membership benefits, such as ascendancy to a new evolutionary level or a 15% discount on tableware. Before the internet, if you wanted to correct someone on their improper use of a semicolon, you had to train to become a teacher. Or write a stiffly worded, grammatically impeccable letter to the Times. Before the internet, if you were a prince from a far-off land and you wanted to communicate to an esteemed beneficiary that the magnificent sum of $15 million awaited them at the Lagos National Savings Association in exchange for their bank details, you'd have to conduct a series of dispiriting and ultimately unsuccessful phone calls before deciding to just keep the money yourself. Before the internet, if you wanted to know how many caps Martin Keown had won for England in order to settle an argument in a pub, you'd have to consult an encyclopedia containing facts about football, or be Martin Keown. Before the internet, if you wanted to buy a book, you physically had to leave your house and go to a bookshop, which is something you can still do now. Before the internet, if you wanted to send your beloved a picture of your private parts, you would have to avoid eye contact with the sales assistant at Boots. When you picked up your photos, unless your beloved was the sales assistant of Boots, in which case you might give her a cheeky grin. Before the internet, if you wanted to know what kind of dog breed you most resembled, you'd have to send off a cell tissue sample to the Kennel Club, who would then respond to you by formal letter, telling you to grow up. You're no kind of dog breed at all. You know, I guess I shouldn't be too sniffy about the internet, though, you know, because if it wasn't for the internet or Twitter, in fact, you know, I guess I wouldn't be here today. And you might have your own view as to whether that's a good thing or not. But most of my, in fact, pretty much all of my first book were poems that I wrote on Twitter. And a lot of them would conform with what was the then Twitter character limit, I think of 140 characters a few years ago. So they're kind of very short poems. I just want to read just a kind of few of those kind of little poems to you now. I don't think I've really read any of these in public before. So here's the title poem. You took the last bus home. You took the last bus home. Don't know how you got it through the door. You're always doing amazing stuff, like the time you caught that train. Here's another one called Busman's Holiday. I'd always wanted to go on a busman's holiday, So I saved up for 10 years, and then 5 holidays came along at once. And here's one, it's called Frisbee. Frisbee whizzing through the air, above our heads, over the sand, into the water, onto the waves, out to sea. You cried a lot that day. Frisbee was a lovely dog. I've recently been kind of sharing some poems on social media, which I kind of shared a poem a day for like 50 days, and about the 10th poem that I posted up was Frisbee, and somebody on Facebook responded to this poem. They kind of said, I was really enjoying your poems every day. I really like them. And then you posted that one about the dog Frisbee, and I didn't like it at all. In fact, I was thinking about buying one of your books, but I'm not going to now. You know, so, you know, not only have I lost a dog, I've lost a potential sale there, which is... So, yeah, so I was kind of working whilst working in an office whilst writing these poems, and I'd quite often have an idea as I kind of walk to work, and I'd tap them into my phone and kind of send out my poem when I got into the office. And quite a few of the poems in the book were inspired by working in an office itself. I'm going to share one of those with you now. It's a poem that's called New Year Office Chit Chat. And it's about that that kind of excruciating time where you've been off on your Christmas break and you come back into the office, you really don't want to be there. You just want a bit of quiet time, you know, just to yourself. And what you don't want to have is one of those conversations about what have you been up to over Christmas. Because everyone's Christmas is essentially the same, aren't they? So you're trying to get a bit of quiet time, you know, making a cup of tea or by the water cooler, and then someone kind of walks up to you and kind of asks you that question. So you have to have the usual conversation. New Year office chit-chat. How was your Christmas, you ask? And I think of the blood-stained rug and the silent scraping of the spade in the garden at midnight. And the wash, wash, washing of my hands. And the dreams, those endless dreams which haunt the night time and smudge their thumbprints on the day to come. And I reply, super thanks. Yours? So having spent a bit of time on social media at the beginning, I soon realised actually that I was kind of operating in a very kind of visual kind of media, and it kind of struck me that if I could find ways to present my poems in a kind of visually interesting way, that might kind of get people's interest and retweets. Because being a poet is all about the retweets; it's not about critical acclaim or anything like that. So I ended up kind of writing poems about Venn diagrams and kind of creating them in the shape of Venn diagram, and on Scrabble boards and Excel spreadsheets and PowerPoint presentations and so forth. And a lot of these poems are quite difficult then to kind of read kind of live, because they're so kind of wrapped up with the kind of style. But I have found one which I want to kind of read to you now, because I think this one does work too. So this is a poem that's called Roger's Thesaurus. It's a poem about thesaurus, so it's essentially a poem about words. And I don't know if you probably can't see it from here, but not only is it a poem about words, but I've actually used words to write it. So I'm going to read this one. In order to grow, expand, widen his lexicological corpus, Roger bought, acquired, purchased a synonymopedia, a thesaurus. Soon, presently, without delay, he no longer ran out of things to say, speak, utter, express, articulate, give voice to, pronounce, communicate. One thing I'm doing in this poem is I kind of get to a certain word and then I list a whole bunch of synonyms afterwards. And that's really, you know, what gives the poem its comic power. So just listen out and, enjoy it. This was all very well, fine, great, wonderful, super, terrific. But his friends, mates, pals thought him boring, tedious, dull, soporific. So let this be a warning, an omen, a sign, a premonition. It's all very well to show learning, education, knowledge, erudition. But here's a top tip, a suggestion, some advice. Don't ever let it stop you from being concise. Brief, short, clear, pithy, succinct, compendious, to the point. Breviloquent. Yeah, so when this book came out, the publisher of it, Unbound, wondered whether it should have one of those kind of stickers on the front that kind of says something like, parental consent needed, explicit lyrics within. Not really because it contained it, I just thought it might sell more copies that way. But there are, there's the occasional kind of more kind of erotic poem in here. So I'm going to read one of these to you now. It's a poem called Chore Play. If you are of a more sensitive disposition, you might want to leave the community hall now. Or you might just want to leave the hall now anyway. Chore Play. Let's make love as soon as we are able, when the plates are cleared from the table, the dishwasher stacked neatly and the surfaces completely wiped clean of crumbs and yolk. We can leave the pans to soak. Let's make our love fast and urgent, once I bought some more detergent. Because the backlog of laundry is simply quite extraordinary. We really should do it oftener. I'll also get some fabric softener. Let our bodies writhe and manoeuvre when I've finished with the Hoover. I know that it's rather late, but the house is in a state and our schedule has got off kilter. I think we need to change the filter. Let our love be reckless, exciting, after I've done the recycling. The lilac sack securely tied and placed in the street outside, careful not to cause obstruction. And so begins the sweet seduction. So that's it. there's a kind of erotic strain that runs through my most recent collection too. And actually, bizarrely, if you go to has anyone heard of they're called Amazon, a website called Amazon? They're we talked about the internet, so they're on the internet. They're kind of like a giant shop where you can get pretty much everything. And one of the things they sell are books. And if you look at their listings, their bestsellers for erotic poetry, you will find me almost always at number one in those listings, which never ceases to amuse me. And actually, if you look at my first book, You Took the Last Bus Home, on there, you'll also see that I'm number one in German poetry too. And I feel that tells us a lot about the individual care and attention that Amazon put into their book-selling operation. But I'm going to read this poem from a new collection that's called The Erotic Shards of Hermaclides of Thrace. I've never read this poem before, but it's I didn't write this poem. This was I was brought in to help translate it. Helpfully, there's a little kind of footnote here that explains who Hermaclides of Thrace was. So I'm just going to read this to you now. Hermaclides of Thrace, 680 to 625 BC, was one of the great erotic poets of ancient Greece. Famed for the explicitness of his verse, he is thought to have written more than 15,000 lines of poetry. Sadly, all that remains are these fragments here, 32 lines and a mere 132 words, painstakingly assembled from the broken shards of a 3rd century Thessalian pot. And so I'm going to read this poem. Just be aware that, you know, we don't have the entire poem, unfortunately. We may never know what some of the phrases are, but you know, I'll do my best with the words that we have. I confess I did tremble, for even the stiffest of branches must quiver with the first drops of rain after a long summer drought. The eastern wind, no less than the mighty Euros himself, carried you gently to me, whispering your name among the dripping leaves. Oh, what love we made. For you were not of mortal descent, but like a... I showed you my... And in return, you opened your... And let me... To gaze on such magnificence. In a frenzy, we began to... Until... Engorged. As sweet as peach juice and down your thighs. We lay there while still stroking each other's and gasping like, until we heard the angry shouts of Zeus, your father. I fled across the field in terror, clutching my shriveled and my vestments. That's the end of that poem. So that's the first section of this book is kind of provides this sort of little potted history of love from the earliest times to the present day. And I want to read one of the more contemporary poems about love, which is the title poem of this book, Alexa, What Is There to Know About Love? And for anyone who doesn't know what an Alexa is, remember we talked about Amazon a bit earlier? So Alexa is a gadget that Amazon sells, and you can, it's a really handy little device. What you can do is you can order it from Amazon and you can pop it on your bookcase or your mantelpiece, and you can ask it questions. It will search the internet to find the answers to those questions, or alternatively you can just kind of ignore it and it will just sort of sit there and listen to you and learn stuff about you in order for Amazon then to come and sell you more stuff further down the line. So it's a really great little gadget, that is. And here's a poem about someone who's got an Alexa who decides to ask it a bunch of questions. Alexa, what is there to know about love? What is there to know about love? A glove is a garment that covers the hand. For protection from the cold or dirt. And Alexa, how does a human heart work? How does a human heart work? Blood is first received in the right atrium via two veins, the vena cava superior and inferior. Alexa, where do we go to when we die? Where do we go to when we die? Activating Google Maps. Completed activation. Would you like to start from your current location? Alexa, what does it mean to be alone? What does it mean to be alone? It is the silence left by words unsaid, the cold expanse of half a bed. It is the endless stretching of the hours, the needless tending of plastic flowers. It is an echo unanswered in a cave, the fateful ping of the microwave. It is the fraying of a worn shirt cuff and the how, Alexa, stop! That's enough. So the very first poem in the collection, again, is another one which I didn't write myself, another one I translated, and it's a poem called The Caveman's Lament, and it's considered to be the world's oldest surviving love poem. It was written something like 1.5 million years ago by one of our earliest ancestors, Homo unrequietus. And it was found carved into a rock just on the outskirts of Hemel Hempstead. I don't know if you know with the ring road where the little chef is, just there. So I was brought in to help with the translation from the very Old English, and it goes like this, the caveman's lament. Me think about her when sun rises. Me think about her when sun sets. Me say to her how much me love her. She tell me love invent not yet. Me make cave all warm and cozy. Me lie bearskin on cave floor. Me play song of love on bone flute. She choose cave of Tim next door. Me no more go out hunt mammoth. Me throw spear too short or long. Me sit in cave, me paint her picture. She say me got perspective wrong. Me cook meal to show me love her. Diplodocus with fried beans. She say food anachronistic. Me not know what this means. Stone Age mighty hard for lovers, yet rub two flints, look what you get. Small sparks lead to big inferno, but she say love invent not yet. Oh, yes, it's a very touching poem, very touching. And it's a poem that I kind of shared on Twitter for the first time. You know, it was kind of generally kind of, you know, well received. People kind of retweeted it and kind of said they liked it. And then I noticed that actually someone actually didn't like it quite so much. And I read her tweet, and she'd written that this poem filled her with all kinds of rage. good old Twitter. And she went on to then clarify the precise kinds of rage with which she was being filled, when she went on to say, all kinds of rage regarding the history of writing, how poetry works, and what we know about the development of language. there were 23 people on Twitter who liked her comment, and then she went on to talk about the ancient Sumerian civilization and the glories and the sophistication that accompanied the poetry of the ancient Sumerians. And it made me feel, you know, rather kind of, you know, I don't know, sad for my little caveman. There he was all those years ago, pouring out his heart, failing to get the girl, and only to find that, you know, 1.5 million years later, there were 23 people on social media pointing out the inferiority of his words compared to the words of the ancient Sumerian civilization, which is a civilization, I hasten to add, which must have come along something like 1 million years after he had died. And it didn't seem very fair. And but I guess there isn't much that is fair when it comes to love. And the ancient Greeks, who were generally quite a clever bunch of people, were forever wrestling with questions surrounding it, such as Mrs. Plato, when she has to contend with her husband's latest theorising about the subject. Hard day at the Agora, I asked him, as he polished off his supper. I could sense him eyeing me nervously. There were chickpeas in his beard again. Earlier, he put his hands down his tunic and whipped out, with a flourish, a crumpled white rose, so I could tell something was up. I've been thinking, he said, never a good sign that, about love. Now this was more promising. I adjusted my girdle. It's about time we moved things to the next level, he announced grandly. I wondered whether I should get the goat butter out. But then he began to prattle about truth and virtue and whatnot, and I thought better of it. Goes rancid ever so quick in this heat. I went upstairs instead and waited for him. There'll be none of that now, he said, once he climbed in and removed my hand. He turned away from me, untouchable, like a newly formed republic asserting its independence. I didn't cross his borders for months. We are trying to reach a state beyond carnal desire, he grumbled piously the night he moved himself into the spare room. He might have been, I wasn't. I'd had my fill of virtue. But by then, what did it matter? Aristippus of Cyrene had arrived on the scene, was busy educating me in his own school of thought. 5 afternoons a week, in fact. He knocked on my door one Tuesday and thrust a flyer into my hand. "Join the hedonists," I read. He asked if I'd like to find out more. "Oh, yes," I said, "with pleasure." So, yeah, I'm going to do one of the more, contemporary poems about love again. So this poem is called Love in the Age of Google, Google's search engine that you might encounter on the internet. So it's a bit like, just in the age of my audience, it's a bit like Ask Jeeves, really. like a fancy version of Ask Jeeves. And it's an example of what is a found poem. So if anyone doesn't know what a found poem is, it's where, I guess, the words pre-exist in some form already, and then you get a sort of artist or, you know, like a master craftsman or whatever comes along and takes those words and sculpts them into a kind of work of beauty like this one. So they went onto Google search engine, and one of the great things about Google is you can type in a few words and then you can see previous searches that users have done. They kind of pop up there. So I picked some of my favourite ones there and integrated them into this poem. And I think it's a really kind of interesting way to write a poem. And partly because I think it gives us some very real insights into contemporary preoccupations with the nature of love. But also in that I didn't have to write any of these words myself. In fact, I just had to kind of put them in some vague order that kind of roughly rhymed. And I think for that reason, it's a format I'm looking to do a lot more with in the future. So these are all kind of Google searches. Is love an abstract noun? Is love a verb? Is love actually on Netflix? Is love a word? Love is a temporary madness. Love is a hurricane. Love is a smoke made with the fume of sighs. Love is a losing game. Can love last forever? Can love break your heart? Can love to shop vouchers be used online? Can love bite scar? Love can build a bridge. Love can set you free. Love can hurt Ed Sheeran. Love cannot heal me. Does love cure depression? Does love have an age? Does Lovejoy marry Charlotte? Does love always fade? Love does not need an explanation. Love does not exist. Love doesn't need a slogan. Love is all there is. It's always come as a bit of a surprise to me that I ended up writing a book which had so many kind of love-based poems in it. And I feel quite glad that I did now. I don't know if you saw, it's another change from this government from last year, but they've kind of changed the rules about obtaining or renewing a poetic license these days. And apparently... apparently now something like 50% of your output needs to be poems about love. So that's kind of helped a lot here. I think also in the other stipulations are that you need to write at least 5 poems a year about the moon, 2 or 3 poems a year about a pet, preferably a cat, but dogs also will do, and 1 poem a year about having a spiritual reawakening whilst walking on a beach in Suffolk. I've still got mine to do, so I'm a little bit worried. I've got about another 3 weeks on that one. So here's another poem. It takes a slight different direction. It's called She'd Dance. She'd dance like no one was watching, although she liked to think he was. The kitchen was her grand ballroom. Her partner was a mop. She'd foxtrot among the pots and pans. She'd pass a doble to the sink. and as she swept across the floor, her mind danced too. She'd think of how he'd held her in his arms at the Locarno and the Ritz, whirling, waltzing, a world apart in the years before the kids, and longer still before the shadow the doctor spotted on his lungs. How dazzlingly they had danced, how dizzyingly she had spun. Her neighbours saw her sometimes, shuffling bent-backed to the shops, but at home she'd dance like no one was watching, although she liked to think he was. Oh, it sounds awful, isn't it, a book with all these love poems, but fortunately most of the poems about love are generally about unrequited love or love going wrong, which are two subjects quite close to my own heart. Here's an example of the former. It's called The Unrequited Love of an Olympic Pole Vaulter. Yes, it is. I guess it wasn't meant to be. Your bar was set too high for me. It's been 4 years since we last met. I haven't got over you yet. And here's one about love going wrong. It's really about, it's called Wedding Anniversary, but it's about kind of being kind of organised and not forgetting important stuff. Although it's about wedding anniversary, it could apply to remembering your partner's, you know, birthday or the date you first met, or Valentine's Day or whatever. And so here's a poem about somebody who's forgotten a wedding anniversary and tries really hard to concoct a good kind of reason for not, you know, for kind of messing up, essentially. I forgot, I said. But since when was our love built on anything so ordinary as a date? Let other couples mark time. I'm too caught up with the here and now of you to waste these hours in commemoration of the past. Because our love is vast, like an ocean with depths far beyond others' comprehension. Why spend our lives swimming circles in the muddy puddle of convention? Flowers fade, chocolates get eaten. By such ephemera, we should judge our love not. And you said, what do you mean you forgot? Forgetting such things is not something I would do myself, of course. I consider myself to be quite an organised person, actually, to such a degree that when this book came out around the time of the first lockdown, and I was quite keen to get in it, this poem is called To-Do List, because it came at a time when a lot of people were working from home, often for the first time, and they were kind of struggling to kind of organise themselves in that sort of domestic setting. So I thought, you know, I could kind of share the benefit of my own experience, some of the kind of best practices, particularly in terms of, you know, the importance of having a good, accurate to-do list. And I think, for me, what really works is to make your goals and objectives realistic and kind of achievable. So I included this in the book. It's, I guess, in many ways, it reflects, and that's just an average day in my working life. And it goes, it's kind of written a bit like a to-do list too. And it goes like this: delay, defer, equivocate. Make some tea, procrastinate. Look at Twitter, stroke the cat, readjust the thermostat. Dawdle, dither, hem and haw. Fill the kettle, chew my jaw. Write 9 words, spin on chair, play 6 games of solitaire. Observe the merry dappled light dancing on the page of white. Review my words, paper scrunch, stroke the cat, break for lunch. Prioritise new tasks to shirk, ponder changing world of work. Look at Twitter, spin on chair, make a brew, loiter, stare. Check out latest cricket score. Reorganise the kitchen drawer. Write 9 words. Cross 6 out. stroke the cat, stoke self-doubt. Make tea, stroke cat, cricket stare, Twitter, chair spin, solitaire. Stroke tea, make cat, twicket, wallow. Write to-do list for tomorrow. Now, one of the more troubling aspects of writing a book and getting it published is that some people take it upon themselves to read it, and others take it upon themselves to review it. And when my Costa shortlisted novel Diary of a Somebody came out, I was kind of doing an event just down the road, actually, in Malvern. And news came to me that the Daily Mail were planning to run a review of it the following day. And to be honest with you, my hopes for a positive review weren't particularly high. Not least because in my first collection, I'd written a poem that's called "How Much I Dislike the Daily Mail." I would rather eat quavers that are 6 weeks stale, tie up the man bun of Gareth Bale, listen to the songs of Jimmy Nail than read one page of the Daily Mail. If I were bored in a waiting room in Perivale, on a 12-hour trip on network rail, halfway through a circumnavigational sail, I would not read the Daily Mail. I would happily read the autobiography of Dan Quayle, 1001 Things You Can Do with Kale, selected scripts from Emmerdale, if it meant I didn't have to read the Daily Mail. Far better to stand outside in a storm of hail, be blown out to sea by a powerful gale, scratch a blackboard with a fingernail, than have to read the Daily Mail. If I were blind, and it was the only thing in Braille, I still would not read the Daily Mail. So when the review came through from the Daily Mail for the book that was going to be shortlisted for the Costa Book Awards, I'm pleased to say that they didn't disappoint me. I got it here. So Daily Mail review, 20th June 2019. They wrote, "There are shades of Adrian Mole, but I'm afraid I mostly found this man irritating. I also preferred the prose to the poems, even though I know some are bad on purpose." I wasn't too disappointed, really, not least because, by coincidence, just about 3 days before I had that review from them, I'd actually written a review of the Daily Mail, in which I'd written, "There are shades of journalism, but I'm afraid I mostly found this newspaper morally loathsome. I also preferred the quizzes to the articles, even though I know some are racist on purpose." Another poem they wouldn't have enjoyed from my first collection is my poem called Refugees. And I wrote this quite a few years ago now in response to these poor people that I kind of put on the television, saw these poor kind of news footage of these poor people who were drowning in the Mediterranean. And I went from my television onto social media and I started reading the kind of reaction to this news story. And whilst most people on there were full of compassion and horror as to what was happening, there were also people on there who seemed almost kind of glad that these people were losing their lives. And I wanted to kind of write a poem that kind of put those views almost side by side, but kind of ended in a way that was a kind of positive affirmation of our need to support refugees. So that's this poem, Refugees. It's a kind of thing you might have to bear with it at first. It does kind of sound just like another daily memo coming out of Priti Patel's home office department. So you just need to get beyond that bit. They have no need of our help. So do not tell me these haggard faces could belong to you or me should life have dealt a different hand. We need to see them for who they really are. Chancers and scroungers, layabouts and loungers with bombs up their sleeves, cutthroats and thieves. They are not welcome here. We should make them go back to where they came from. They cannot share our food, share our homes, share our countries. Instead, let us build a wall to keep them out. It is not okay to say these are people just like us. A place should only belong to those who are born there. Do not be so stupid to think that the world can be looked at another way. The world can be looked at another way. Do not be so stupid to think that a place should only belong to those who are born there. These are people just like us. It is not okay to say build a wall to keep them out. Instead, let us share our countries, share our homes, share our food. They cannot go back to where they came from. We should make them welcome here. They're not cutthroats and thieves with bombs up their sleeves, layabouts and loungers, chancers and scroungers. We need to see them for who they really are. Should life have dealt a different hand, these haggard faces could belong to you or me. So do not tell me they have no need of our help. So I mentioned my novel Diary of a Somebody earlier. I think what I forgot to mention was the fact it got shortlisted for the Costa book prize. Not for the main one, just for the kind of first novel. But it didn't win. I don't feel bitter about that at all. Just delighted to be part of it all. But it's a sort of a diary of a loser poet who's called Brian Bilston. Brian has this kind of monthly poetry club that he goes. It's kind of it's very much the centre of his kind of social existence. And in February, in his diary, a woman called Liz comes into a poetry club, and she quickly becomes the subject of Brian's romantic interest, and indeed his erotic daydreams. And an example of the latter is in his diary entry for the 1st of May, in which he writes, "The erotic dreams have returned. I'd misused a semicolon. Liz kept me behind for corrective therapy. I was to go through a set of uncorrected proofs for a new book in the 50 Shades of Grey series. And for every mistake I found, she'd remove an item of clothing. And for each one I missed, she'd put one on. I woke up just as she was putting on a third cardigan. Over her blouse, tank top and pullover." But incredibly, Liz, Brian's attentions toward Liz are kind of reciprocated, and they end up going out on a date together, and they decide to go to an art gallery, and Brian feels quite sort of worried about this. He doesn't know much about art. He's going to appear to be rather kind of ignorant. So he spends a kind of few weeks taking all the books out he can from the library and from his local bookshop and reading up about modern art. And he ends up writing a poem entitled A Brief History of Modern Art in Poetry, in which he takes the kind of the old trope of roses are red, violets are blue, and translates that for the different kind of poetry forms. So I'm going to read some of these to you now. So this is Impressionism. Roses sway in softened reds, violets swim in murky blues. Sugar sparkles in the light, blurring into golden hue. Nice. Surrealism. Roses are melting. Violets are too. Ceci n'est pas le sucre. Keith is a giant crab. Abstract expressionism. So, you violet sweet. Roses, you are is. Red are roses, blue. Sugar? I don't know what I was thinking about. Anyway, social realism. Roses are dead. Violence is rife. Don't sugarcoat this bitter life. Pop art. Roses go blam. Violets go pow. Sugar is cool. You are so wow. Conceptual art. Roses are red, coated in blood. A deer's severed head drips from above. One of the other major things in Brian's life is the presence of a kind of rival poet who's called Toby Salt. And Toby is kind of everything that Brian is not. He's kind of critically acclaimed. He's always on the television and radio. He kind of reviews stuff. And he's got a collection of poetry coming out called This Bridge No Hands Shall Cleave with a boutique poetry publisher. And Brian gets increasingly jealous of Toby's success in the course of the diary, and with good reason. Actually, when we see some of the things that Brian's writing, we can see that he's having a few problems. So take this from January the 26th. His diary entry says, "The bin men have pinned a note to the man at number 29's rubbish bags, informing him that as he put out more than the regulatory number of sacks to be collected, 5, they will not be removing any of them today. I wanted to write a poem about refuse collection, refuse being both a synonym for rubbish and also a verb which means to turn down, and thus working brilliantly on 2 separate levels. But some days the words I would like to write are not the ones I end up writing." And his poem for that day is called "This Is Not the Poem That I Had Hoped to Write." This is not the poem that I'd hoped to write. When I sat at my desk and the page was white, you see, there were other words that I'd had in mind, yet this is what I leave behind. I thought it was a poem to eradicate war, one of such power it would heal all the sores of a world torn apart by conflict and schism. It isn't. Lovers, I'd imagined, would quote from it daily. Mothers would sing it to soothe crying babies, and whole generations would be given new hope. Nope. I had grand aspirations. Believe me, I tried. Humanity examined with lessons applied. But the right words escaped me. So often they do. Have these in lieu. I'm not sure I've ever read one of Toby Salt's poems, but I think I might do that now. So here is a, because I think it might be helpful to to compare and contrast Toby's poetry with Brian's poetry. So here's one of Toby's, which won a competition in the January issue of Well Versed, the quarterly magazine for the discriminating poet. And it's a poem that's called "Theogony and the Ecstasy." I don't know what theogony is. I've written it in a book, and I have no idea what that word means. Okay, so here's Toby Salt. "A rock for a jail, and nothing but the wind for company. Oh, Aeolian confidant, dry my salty locks and whisper the world into my ear. The latest stock market news. A child strangled, the shaming of a politician, and all the snarling of the gutter press. the jingle of my jailer's keys as they bounce upon his thigh. But no, these chains, this rock. What do you bring exactly? Only betrayal. The dread beat of a cypripedium's wings, the daily agonies and my ripped out liver shining at my feet, surrounded by rock pools, ruby red. Here's one of Brian's. It's called The Day My Dog Spontaneously Combusted. There he was, chasing sticks, doing tricks and all that stuff. Next minute, woof. Here's another one. This is Brian, not Toby. It's called Crime Weave. Upon retiring from the mafia, Don Corleone wove aquatic mammals out of raffia. I learnt this news when he made me an otter I couldn't refuse. Is it a poem? Is it a joke? Maybe we don't know. So maybe I feel like I've gone full circle, really, because one of the things that Brian sets out to do in his diary is to write a poem for every day of the year, and I think he gets to about the 2nd of January, and so, when he kind of fails to write one. Like I said, that's something I've done in my forthcoming book. So I'm going to finish with another one from there. This is a poem for the 30th of December. I'll read you a little blurb that accompanies it. So it says, Rudyard Kipling, the English poet, short story writer, and novelist, was born on this day in 1865. At the age of 41, he became the first English language writer to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, and he remains the youngest. He wrote exceedingly good stories. But his reputation was... See, what I've done there... I don't think anyone's made that link between the Kiplings, have they? So my poem for that day is a reworking of Kipling's famous poem, If. I'm going to finish with this one, but I've reworked it to reflect the current incumbent of number 10. If you can keep your job when all around you lies ravaged from what it is you've done, if intellect and common sense confound you, and if integrity you have but none, if you can lie and not be tired by lying and pretend you act for the public good, but then leave the people to their dying and say you did sadly all you could, if you can dream of nothing more than power, if you can think but only of yourself, if you believe this country's finest hour is when the chosen few can gain more wealth, if you can flout the law with bluff and bluster and not care whether you are believed, or deny with scorn every single blunder and not care how many you may deceive, if you can stir up hatred, fear and violence to create division to suit your ends, and answer cries for help with silence, and then laugh about it with your friends. If you can stretch this country to its limit, or until it is, you've had your fun. Yours is this land and everything that's in it. And as you wished, you'll be PM, my son.